I had the distinct pleasure of having dinner with Dr. Ocampo last night. I can't tell you how lucky we are to have her here. First of all, her flight, which was going to be yesterday morning, was canceled the night before because there's a snowstorm in Washington, D.C. Who knew? I know. But luckily, she totally changed her schedule, jumped on a plane the night before, and because of that hurried rush, I think we get a special, extra special part of the presentation today, which I'll let you point to. It has to do with breaking language barriers. Dr. Ocampo works with NASA. The story that she tells, which is so wonderful, she grew up in Argentina and came to the United States as a teenager. And when she stepped foot in the U.S., she said, "Okay, where's NASA?" She found it. She'll tell that story. She is also deeply connected to her research, was part of the work that found the Chicxulub. How's that? Crater. I get a half nice try. Pronunciation's my specialty. No, it's not. Does anybody know what that crater is tied to? It's in the Yucatan Peninsula. Bingo, the dinosaur killer. Yeah, good answer. So, very exciting stuff. You don't want to hear me talk anymore. Dr. Ocampo, please come to the stage.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Well, good morning. It truly is a pleasure to be here this morning with you. And I'm very grateful to the PI Institute, Perimeter Institute, for giving me this opportunity, as well as the Center for Women in Science that Dr. Shahimi founded. So it's a delight to see so many bright young faces, and the future of the planet, I know, is in great hands because it's in your hands. So thank you for giving me then the opportunity to start this dialogue. I wanted to start by telling you a little bit. I mean, we remember that we live in a solar system, and as you can see, the arrow says, okay, you're here, planet Earth. But we sometimes forget that our solar system is extraordinary. It's a very dynamic, changing place. The best illustration we had probably just a few days ago, the asteroid that impacted in Russia. How many of you heard about that? It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, there are rocks, as we shall see, everywhere that's around us, and they are key. They are key to why we're here today, why impact processes played a key role, not only in the formation of our planet, but in the formation of the universe. So remember that your solar system is your playground. And with that, then, I wanted to move to the next slide and just tell you a little bit of what we will discuss today. I wanted to share with you what a planetary geology does. How many of you know what planetary geology is? Okay, great. So we'll start by I like to share and invite you, since I cannot take you all with me to the field, that's what geologists love to do, and planetary geologists, ideally we would like to be doing field work in the surface of Mars or some exotic planet in our solar system, but since we are not there yet, we use robotic spacecrafts to help us. And we do what we call geology, comparative geology or comparative planetology. So I'm going to share with you a little video, start with Shane Yutz, so what we do, and show you a little bit of what a science expedition is. And I hope at the end of that you love to go and consider planetary geology as one of your possible science careers. Then I wanted to share some thoughts with you that have served me well, and I hope that I hope you find useful. And then I'll invite you to our virtual spacecraft, and we'll conclude with some Q&A. So with that, I'd like to then start with the video that talks a little bit about what a planetary geology does.
NSC, report spacecraft,
and if we can
go.
Lower the
spacecraft
lights, please.
Go.
Copy that, thank you.
NAP is on internal power, ready for launch.
Copy that, thank you.
Adriana Ocampo is a space explorer. She's not an astronaut. She's a NASA geologist on a quest for space objects on Earth. Not now, but millions of years ago.
I love what I do because it's a dream that we all have to be able to just go and play in the dirt, and I'm able to do it for a living. And in the process, I also learn a lot about science, and that's what keeps it exciting, because every moment can be a discovery. Oh my God, guys, we found it! There is enough evidence that has been presented that we can say that there was a big asteroid or comet that impacted the Earth and caused a global mass extinction. You really have to be doing the detective work to identify impact craters.
NSC, report spacecraft, go.
Spacecraft is go.
10, 9, 8, 7, nighters armed, green board, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket exploring the past and future of our universe. Vehicle on course.
A planetary geologist has the opportunity.
NSC, report spacecraft, go.
Spacecraft is go. Copy that, thank you.
NAP is on internal power, ready for launch.
Copy.
Oh, well.
That's interesting. Copy that, thank you.
Adriana Ocampo is a space explorer. She's not an astronaut. She's a NASA geologist on a quest for space objects on Earth. Not now, but millions of years ago.
I love what I do because it's a dream that we all have to be able to just go and play in the dirt, and I'm able to do it for a living. And in the process, I also learn a lot about science, and that's what keeps it exciting, because every moment can be a discovery. Oh my God, guys, we found it! There is enough evidence that has been presented that we can say that there was a big asteroid or comet that impacted the Earth and caused a global mass extinction. You really have to be doing the detective work to identify impact craters.
NSC, report spacecraft, go.
Spacecraft is go.
10, 9, 8, 7, nighters armed, green board, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket exploring the past and future of our universe. Vehicle on course.
A planetary geologist has the opportunity of learning more about our planet by studying the planets in our solar system. And it's a relatively young discipline that really got started with space exploration. We look at images that have been radioed down from the spacecraft that are orbiting Mars, for example, and then we study them in detail and manipulate them with computers and develop different techniques that will allow us to learn from them and then compare it to our own planet, the Earth.
Adriana combs through hundreds of remote sensing photos each year, but one image stands out. It's an ancient impact area in remote South America, and it's become the focus of her field work. Today, she's reviewing the images with geologist Kevin Pope.
Here we have the ground zero then in the Yucatan Peninsula, Chicxulub impact.
We're in the process of planning our expedition to Belize and the Yucatan Peninsula to study the material that created the Chicxulub impact crater 65 million years ago. The Chicxulub story, the study with a Landsat image taken by a spacecraft. There was a very intriguing feature. There was like black dots that were, as you put them together, form a semicircle. These black dots turned out to be pools of water, which they're called sinkholes, or in the Mayan Spanish word would be cenote. And it was very intriguing because this was an enormous feature that you could only see it from a point of view of a spacecraft. It was over 110 kilometers in diameter. It was the surface expression of a buried impact crater.
But to make sure that what they are seeing in the photographs really has occurred in the ancient past, they need to go to the source.
Belize is a wonderful locality. It's very beautiful. There's a lot of lush vegetation and beautiful wildlife. But it's not your typical place for geologists. Geologists tend to go to deserts, places where you have rocks readily accessible and there's not very much vegetation. This process of finding and searching was quite challenging.
We're in Camembert Highway between Belmopan and Armenia.
These localities in Belize are really unique in the world because they are the only ones that show what happens after the first few seconds and minutes and hours after the impact.
What we had to do is look for quarries, areas that already man have come and digged up the rock and was pouring it, in this case, to build the roads in Belize.
Okay, guys, welcome to Albion Quarry. Here we are.
Albion Quarry is enormous. A gaping hole in the ground made from mining boulders to make gravel for roadways. And for all the time that quarry workers have been hard at work making gravel, they've actually created a huge science lab blasted out of the rock. As they make their way to examine the rock layers up close, Adriana's excavators are literally treading on the Chicxulub catastrophe. The ground beneath them is rocks and boulders ejected from the asteroid impact 65 million years ago.
And it's unique in the world because it's the only place where we can come and study the material that was ejected from a large impact event. In the other impact craters around the world that still exist, all this material has been eroded, so we don't have an opportunity to come and study it.
Working in the quarry, Adriana has found a passion for space exploration here on Earth. With each rock sample, she is unearthing clues about heavenly bodies that have impacted our planet in the far, far past.
Since I was a very little girl, I was dreaming about space. It just completely intrigued me. I used to just climb to the roof of my house in Argentina back there and trying to view the stars and wonder what were those sparkle of lights.
Houston, all your systems are looking good going around.
I very much recall very clearly on July 20th, 1969, when I was in Argentina watching through TV the first time a human being stepped its foot in another planet.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And I realized, gosh, that's fantastic. I couldn't believe we were viewing images from another world. And these incredible soils and rocks, and that completely intrigued me, and I realized I was hooked. And that's how planetary geology came into my life.
Wanted to share a little bit of the excitement that is being part of the planetary geologist discipline, and that involves, as you could see, using spacecrafts. It involves using all the data that comes down from those spacecraft, robotic spacecraft, to Earth, and then comparing it and doing some geology on our planet to learn more about the evolution of our planet, where it has been and where it will be. It's been an extraordinary opportunity to be part of a discipline that is a very young discipline in many aspects. So I wanted then to continue sharing just some thoughts with you that have served me well, and I thought I will share them. So the key, I think, whatever your passion is, to follow it, never to give up on it. And even if, for example, you haven't yet identified what that passion is, it's okay. Just remember, you're living in extraordinary times. You're the architect of your life. You can now have the opportunity of merge or tailor your careers. Think of, for example, putting astronomy with biology, and you come up with astrobiology. That's another recent discipline that has evolved, that has to do with the origin of life. So what other examples you can give me if you merge two different disciplines? Anybody? Go ahead, just voice them. Bioengineering, that's right, biology and engineering, that's another excellent example. There was some other, yes? Astrophysics, astronomy and physics. Yes, in the back. Statistical ecology. Statistical ecology, that's a newer one that has to do with the evolution, yes, of life. And medical illustration. So, that's the key. Remember, you can tailor it to your tastes and come and create your passion. Come and create, and that creativity will be an asset to you and an asset to the world, because you will be the best at it. Have faith in yourself. You can do whatever it is that you decide to do in your life, that your career path. You will encounter people, folks, that will tell you no. But you think, no is another way to get to your yes. And thank those people that appear in your past that give you the no's, because they are the ones that are going to teach you to find other options, to broaden. One of the things that I have learned by working all these years through NASA is that failure does not really truly exist. Because through that experience, you learn how to do things better. And that is how you arrive to your success, how you arrive to obtaining your goals. So have faith on yourself. Have tenacity on your dreams. Those dreams are going to carry you through the good times and the bad times. I had the privilege of meeting an extraordinary astronomer. I don't know how many of you know Carl Sagan. He was a great communicator of science. And he basically inspired you to really go and explore. I know many, many young people that they continue a career in a space exploration thanks to his series that was called Cosmos. He gave me one time, I think, three magic words: maps, I mean, dreams are maps. Dreams are maps. Think of it. Your dreams, again, are the map, the path that will take you to that goal. And finally, I wanted to share something because I truly believe that there is nothing that is impossible. When we hear that word, impossible, most of us think of barriers that we cannot continue or follow, and yet the word by its, if we look at it, many of times the answer is right there in front of us. Impossible. The same word tells us. So, well, with that then, now very quickly, I wanted to invite you to go in a virtual space trip with me. And we'll go and explore, and we will travel in space and time. And here's the language challenge, because this will be in Spanish. But I hope you, with your French background, some of you, and I'll try to translate as we go along. So this is Cosmic Collisions and Dinosaurs. And our trip starts in a very far, far away galaxy, long, long time ago, actually 4.5 billion years ago. And this trip will take us to the beginning of where our galaxy, this beautiful spiral galaxy that it was in formation, and we're traveling towards its center. It's important to remember the center of almost all galaxies now that we have discovered, they contain a black hole where matter is being consumed. So here we are in the clouds of that primordial soup that created the millions and millions of stars that are in our galaxy. And we were very fortunate because our solar system that we see here in formation was at the edge of that galaxy, of the Milky Way. And we see the sun, a very young sun, with all this material and nebulosity, and those pieces of rocks are the building pieces, the building material where planets started to come about, to be created. So we have a faint star, our sun, and then you see all those, but we don't see any planets orbiting around. How did the planets form? Remember, we're about 4.5 billion years ago. So here where the collision aspect comes to play a key role. As these asteroids collided with each other, you could see some of them started to, the heat of that impact produced like a glue, and they agglutinated, and they started to accrete, to come together and form a protoplanet. Eventually, enough of it, of these collisions took place, and you could see them by the representation of the yellow-orange paths with all the heat, and that's how a lot of the minerals were transferred into the crust of the terrestrial planets. And they were very hot, and you could see our young Earth didn't have oceans, it didn't have an atmosphere, it was just a protoplanet at that stage. It was still very hot from all the collisions and accretion that had taken place. And it had to start, the heavy minerals started to concentrate in its nucleus. But what happens? Look, there's another protoplanet about to collide, and it did. And this protoplanet collision play a key role in our system. That's how the moon got formed. Eventually, it started orbiting, as you could see, in the equatorial plane or ecliptical plane of around the Earth. And through the same process that we saw before, how the Earth got formed through accretion, it started forming in a spherical way and slowly started orbiting around the Earth. This process was actually quite quickly, took about the formation of the Moon, about a month or so that it happened to accrete, and we know that through the Apollo samples that came back, through the chemical analysis. So we see here our system, you know, the Earth and Moon system now cooling off. But how did the oceans and perhaps life came to Earth? And here's where comets keep a key role. And I'm going to introduce you and translate for you at this stage my avatar. And his name is Dino. And he is going to tell us basically why comets were so important. So here's Dino telling us that here's where things get really interesting, because the comets were, by impacting on Earth, were the ones that brought the water molecules into our planet. They probably brought as well the amino acids. So they started probably seeding the oceans. And that's one of the theories that we believe, how, you know, through those impact and bombardment of many, many comets, how oceans could have started. Because as we see, comets are very rich in volatiles. As they get closer to the sun, they start outgassing. And if they impact on a planet, you know, eventually that molecules of water would accumulate. But let's now travel in time to a key time 65 million years ago. And that was key for our planet. This is called the Cretaceous Tertiary period, because that's the last mass extinction that our planet suffered, and is a mass extinction that played a key role on life on Earth, as we shall see. And here's Dino again, talking to Rex, T-Rex.
Hola, Rick. ¿Cómo estás?
And he's telling us, you know, what an amazing place the Earth was. It was warmer, it was the oxygen, it was an oxygen-rich atmosphere. They were kings. They dominated the biosphere for over 250 million years. Slowly, they were depleting the biosphere as well, and things were changing. So, you know, even though they dominated the biosphere, there was something that happened that could not be avoided. And if we look back out through the window of our virtual spacecraft, we'll see a small object, an asteroid, about 10 kilometers in diameter, that is in a trajectory of collision with the planet.
Cuando una roca del espacio cayó en nuestro planeta.
And he tells us how dramatic and how catastrophic that event was. Because in an instant, everything changed. The planet was enveloped by a cloud of dust and hot material that produced global wildfires. So the whole food changed, the biosphere changed. I mean, there was no longer photosynthesis, the food supply stopped for the dinosaurs. The herbivores died, and then the carnivores died, and they could not adapt to such a dramatic and quick change. Our planet became enveloped with clouds of sulfuric acid, And keep that in mind, because we'll find out where that sulfuric acid comes from, and this key to why this extinction happened. It wasn't just the impact, but where the asteroid impacted. The clouds of sulfuric acid took about 12 years to dissipate through acid rain, and our planet became like Venus is today. So this mass extinction that we call the Cretaceous Tertiary, and we see now this line really does pre-mass extinction, you can see the diversity of life that there was, and after that yellow line, there's just a few species that survived, and most of the ones that survived were small species. And all this came to play thanks to a team of investigators from Berkeley, headed by a father and son team, Louis and Walter Alvarez, in which they proposed the asteroid impact theory. And their key piece of evidence was a layer of clay in Italy that they found with a high concentration of iridium. Iridium is an element that is common in the Earth crust, but in minute quantities, and they had found enormous concentrations. So the only way they could explain it is the only source of high amounts of iridium is in asteroids or comets. And this is how they proposed this theory that was extraordinarily controversial. This was in the 1980s. They had not found the crater. So it was, you know, here you have all this evidence, but without the key piece. Where was the crater? And even at that time, the science community, they were able to see craters on the moon, on Mars, but it wasn't really widely believed that there would be that many craters on Earth. In actuality, there is over 160 craters throughout the world, but none of them fitted the characteristics needed for the KT mass extinction. They knew that the asteroid had to be about 10 kilometers, so the size would have had to be enormous, and the dating didn't match. So the hunt for the crater was on, and here's the set of evidence that we had before the crater was found: the iridium, the shock quartz, and tektites. So we'll continue by talking about each of them and to give you a quick idea. So iridium, the key there was that it was globally distributed, and each of these red dots, it tells you the amount of concentration. The larger the dot, the higher the concentration. So that gives you an idea how global this catastrophe was. Then the shock quartz is basically a grain of sand in which the crystal a structure has been deformed by high pressures, and this is another signature of impacts. And then the tektites, which are little, basically, spherules that contain the composition of the target rock, and this is where things got really interesting, because we knew now that the target rock had to be calcium carbonate. I was in a conference in the late 1980s when I saw this paper by geoarchaeologists in which they proposed, they were trying to see what had happened to the Mayan civilization and their cultivation canals. And they had found this incredible, in a landslide mosaic as shown here inside, if you look off the square, you see these dots, these black dots that form that semicircle that I spoke of before. And they didn't know what that meant, why a circle like that. When I was in the audience, like you are today, I was completely intrigued, and I say immediately, I see a circle, I think of impact craters. And I went to talk to them, and we started a collaboration that resulted in a publication in Nature proposing the site of the KT impact crater that today is known as the Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan Peninsula. But as I say before, the key here that I hope you remember is the composition, the amount of sulfur in that target rock that was in the Yucatan Peninsula. That proved to be catastrophic because it brought first a moment of freezing. Our planet would have frozen if it hadn't been for the amount of CO2, which it was, is part of the composition of carbonates, and eventually it warmed up, but it took 12 years. So that was a long time for creatures to hibernate. And we continue looking for more evidence because everything in the Yucatan Peninsula is underneath the ground. So we went to Belize and found a wealth of evidence through six expeditions. Our planet has had six mass extinctions, of which the KT is the last one. And here's why it's important that this happened. And as Dino tells us, what would have happened if disaster or impact which had not taken place? We would have looked probably quite differently.
Tú tendrías la piel como la mía, tus brazos un poco más cortos, tus ojos serían más atractivos, tus dientes serían más útiles. Aquí estás, Adriana.
So this is how we could have looked if this maybe would have evolved into that. So as you can see, we live in a dynamic solar system, in a dynamic, ever-evolving universe. And our spacecraft is planet Earth. So in many ways, we are all astronauts. So we should study so we know how to preserve it better. And with that, I wanted to ask you now to stand up for me. And I want everybody to hold hands. Raise your arms to remember we are all children and daughters of the stars. And today, we're going to make a promise to each other. We are going to promise, I, say your name. We are going to follow our dreams and never give up on them. Thank you. Go on, explore. The universe is your playground. And I wanted, as a memento, I wanted to, I brought some pins for everybody of the Curiosity mission that is exploring the surface of Mars as we speak. So as you go out, please make sure the bag is here in the front and take a pin. Thank you again.
Thank you. Just do question and answer. So stay here.
Oh, yeah.
You can go to the front. Thank you very much. Let's take some time to ask some questions of Dr. Ocampo. It can be about the science, it can be about her career path, any question. And I'll start while you're formulating your question, and there's mics there and mics there. And if we already stood up, so I was going to have you stand up so you could practice that, because then once you're standing up, you just walk to the mic. So we already know that part. You can go to the mic. Here's my question that struck me. Science is so often perceived as this series of facts. You said follow your passion. And to me, the passion seems to be that mystery. And that feels more like science. Am I on the right track there? Is that what your passion was?
Yes, I mean, passion is a very individual word, perhaps. And it's true, it's what it means to you. It really is what it really intrigues you that brings that question that we are all human beings that are innate, it's innate within us to question. And this is something that I cannot emphasize enough. I think one of the things that is truly important, sometimes we take what is written as something that is, you know, true and it's been proven and that's why it's published. But not all the time that's the case. When I started my research in Belize, for example, I went and the whole area had been published and mapped as a completely different age. And yet I was finding things that didn't make sense, you know. It didn't match, they thought that it was much younger rock That's how we had been mapped, and that's how they had all the maps in the world had it like that. And yet, so you know, that's why you have to question, you have to do the detective work, and that's what drives you. And I think that driven, that aspect of wanting to go beyond is part of what the passion could be, you know, for that career path.
Tough question.
Thank you so much for sharing your passion with us. I was just curious about your educational path that you took to get to NASA.
Sure. Well, one of the things I studied in aerospace engineering, and I was, as a very young child, I was, you know, constructing and designing like space colonies. So I thought aerospace engineering was my path. And then I was very, very fortunate. I volunteered for as soon as found out where the first NASA center was close to we were living, I volunteered there, which it turned out to be the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is the center of excellence at NASA for solar system exploration. And I was there when all this data was coming, and it wasn't just the Apollo. I remember the Viking, which is probably it's an old mission. It was the first time we went to Mars in July 20th of 1976, and I got to see that information coming in real time. I was completely intrigued. And again, here we were again in another world, and things seemed so similar. Why was that? Why we had evolved so different? So at that time, planetary geology, planetary science was just starting. So I changed my career path to go to do a degree in geology, and then eventually I did all my degrees in geology, a master's and a PhD. But I always took a lot of courses in aerospace engineering as well, because what it entails to really be part of a mission, you have to know, you know, how a spacecraft, how the instruments. You have to do the risk assessment. So it's all that. And when you're part of planetary exploration or solar system exploration, you are by nature very multidisciplinary. So that's why I encourage you, is don't tailor it, broaden it. I took a lot of courses in many, many different disciplines. It wasn't just geology.
Good. Oh, here comes a question. No, no rush. We'll just everybody turn and watch her walk down the stairs.
Thank you for sharing that path with us. How much collaboration is necessary in your field of work?
Teamwork is key. That's one of the great, is that what you meant, cooperation? Yes, yeah, it truly is in all aspects, not only with your teammates, but it's one of the key lessons that I learned again working at NASA, is you're really a team. Is even though you know, we depend on one another, when we put together a spacecraft, we really are like a family, and we realize that we're able to do this because we work very intimately as a team. But we also, in the broader sense, collaboration is key at the international level. None of these missions will be viable without international collaboration. The Canadian Space Agency today is a key partner for NASA for many of the missions, including for one of the next New Frontiers mission, that is a sample return of an asteroid. There is a instrument that the Canadian Space Agency is building that is called OSIRIS-REx, and is the OSIRIS Laser Altimeter, or OLA. We're very happy that the decision has been made to collaborate, and they will be building an instrument to be on board the spacecraft. So collaboration is key, and I think this is where women have the upper hand, because by nature, I think women are very collaborative, and we work well with teams, and we are very multitasking, and that's the other key aspect of it, of being part of this type of missions and projects. Thank you for your question. Very good one.
There we go. Let's go to this side of the room just to come from the other direction.
Hi there. Thank you for showing us the video. I was just wondering, when you and your team go to a site to dig and explore, what sort of permission do you need to do that?
Well, we work with the countries, and in this case, when I led, to coordinate all those six science expeditions, five of them were to Belize, one was to Italy in Gubbio, which was the original discovery that the Alvarez did. We got through the minister to be able to, in the Belize case, you have to get the permits, and then you register with the Department of Petroleum and Minerals in Belize, they are called, and you leave a sample of whatever you collect and with the locality. And the science papers that came out of them, you also make sure that they get copies. So, and we try to involve, Belize is a very young country, so we also try to involve, there is a university or any of people that were interested in collaborating as well. You're welcome.
Thank you
for the question.
So just yesterday, we were actually talking about the trip to Mars in 2018 and how it's kind of a nonprofit. I was just wondering, how is NASA's research going to contribute to that? Because I know we were talking about it being more of a psychological study as well as orbiting Mars for the 501 days. So what's NASA's participation in that?
Okay, thanks for the question. Yes, it is extraordinary because right now we're evolving into a new phase of space exploration. It's not only done by governmental agencies, but also the private sector is playing a key role. And a lot of the changes are happening. For example, the Kennedy Space Center, which is the center where we do, and you saw the launches, that happened, which, by the way, that was the MAP mission, and that was the number one mission for Steve Hawking. He said that was the most, and it has to do with gravity and gravity waves, and
yes,
they were confirmed and discussed. So, but as a sidebar, I just wanted to mention that. But the Kennedy Space Center now is going to become a spaceport, in which missions like the one that TTOP that you mentioned will be using. The network to be able to communicate in deep space, and by deep space I even mean just going to the moon and to Mars in this case. This mission is going to do an orbit and it's not going to land and they will come back. They plan to do some science. And there is going to be a collaboration there and support. There is also equipment that will be provided and they will be able to send the commands and receive them through the deep space network. All that NASA, all that infrastructure will be part of what NASA will be providing to that effort. Thank you.
I thought it was really cool to learn like how you made your discovery and your big paper. And
Thank
I was wondering
you.
What projects you're working on right now after you made your discovery.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's one of the things that even after you discover something, it's a never ending because we'll continue trying to find the impact of the asteroid trajectory came from, it seems like a trajectory of impact to the south, from the south, but impacted and affected more the northern hemisphere. We do not know really what happened to the whole planet. There is an expedition organized into Patagonia to try to identify what was the effect at that distance. So we want to try to do and attune better our global model of this type of events to really understand if this ever were to happen, what mitigation effects we could do. But I also can continue looking for more impacts, and I'm currently, on the track of a really good one that hopefully I'm working on a publication that I hope it will be coming out shortly. So I continue doing that type of research, and that also seems to have some link to, it's large enough that it has some link to it had an effect on life on our planet as well. So stay tuned.
Somebody defined science as something that you can repeatedly test and observe results. You can't observe the impact of the crater that may, or the asteroid that may have killed the dinosaurs, and you can't repeat something like that. So do you find that people have a hard time sometimes taking you seriously as a scientist, either because they don't consider you a scientist or because you're a woman?
Well,
that was a scatterbrain question. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's good. It's a great question, because it's true. I mean, when this came out, the paper was back in the late 1990s, and I was not yet established as an impact theory researcher. And yeah, they didn't take me seriously. I mean, I was an unknown entity, publishing, and I first submitted the paper to Science, and it got rejected after they kept it for about 8 to 9 months. So I had to resubmit it again in Nature, and eventually it got published as a scientific correspondence, and I had to put a question mark in the title. So a possible site of the KT. So there are challenges. This was so controversial that it really brought, I remember even chairing science sessions in the like the Lunar Planetary Science conferences, and people got really scientists got really passionate about and with very strong opinions. So it was still, even after the amount of evidence, you can replicate in the laboratory this type of velocities. We have the NASA Ames, what it's called. We can replicate the impacts. So we can see at a smaller scales, obviously, what the effects were. And through that, we develop atmospheric modeling, and that's how we came out with the amount of sulfur that was put in the atmosphere. It was like 10 to the 17 grams. That of sulfur that was injected instantaneously into the atmosphere, this is tons and tons. And the amount of energy is like all the that it was imparted at that time, we can measure it and determine through very well-known models as well. So that's part of the science process. You replicate, you are able to do that in laboratories, then you go to the field to confirm it. You can, it's amazing. I love geology because the rocks talk to you if you learn their language, and that's what truly is. And there's so many key information that we were able to gather that information, put it in our computer models, and replicate what had happened to the biosphere. So yeah, science is great. It gives you the tools. You just need to use your head and do it, and you can get the answer. So today we have enough evidence that indeed is confirmed that the Cretaceous Tertiary mass extinction was caused by or precipitated by this asteroid that impacted 65 million years ago. You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
Which side? Let's bounce to that side, and then we'll bounce back to you, and then we'll let the conversation continue during the speed mentoring.
Okay, sure.
I'm back again. I was wondering, you've been working for a while. Have you noticed a significant increase in the number of women in your workplace from now as opposed to before?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's a very good question. When I started working, there was very little diversity. I really didn't have an image, of a person that I could relate to, because not only I was a woman, but I came from another culture. When I came to this country, I didn't speak English. As you can tell, my accent is still quite strong. And so there were a lot of, if you may call them, barriers to overcome. To me, they were not barriers. To me, it was just, I keep chugging along and moving forward. So the diversity wasn't there as much, and especially, as I say, it was a new discipline. But now there is, and it's wonderful to see this field, how it has grown. There is almost, 45% is composed of women. It still is a small community. There's only about 2,000 planetary scientists in the world. So it's a small, and we hope that grows. I always say, that the first humans that will go to another planet, you will have to have definitely planetary scientists, you will have to have geologists on board, and biologists. That's going to be part of the composition of the corps of astronauts that will be going to Mars eventually, I can assure you of that, and it will be very diverse. So talent is the measure. And I hope someday, in your future, will grow beyond that, that gender does not mean anything, only talent and your head and your brains.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
Obviously, we have had some great successes with our studies of impacts on Earth, but should we be able to advance to adequate technology levels, where in the solar system would you like to focus your research next?
Well, the key, I love that whole question of where we came from and how life originated. Do we have niches of life, taking place, currently, right now? One of the missions that we have recently sent, that was launched on August 5th of 2011, it will be going to Jupiter, it will arrive there in 2016. That's the Juno mission. And although its objective and focus is to study Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system, there is a very intriguing moon in the Jupiterian system that's called Europa. You may have heard about it. It has, and why is it intriguing? Because it has the three key components of life as we know it. And what were those components? Was organic material, liquid water underneath this crust of ice, and a source of energy. And Jupiter, it truly is a proto-sun. It emits more energy than it receives. So it seems to be just at that potential habitable niche. And Europa is extraordinary. It's very exciting. There are three places. Enceladus is another one that has those three ingredients, and of course Mars. So but yet, just even going 8 years back, we didn't know a lot of these things. So I think every day is a discovery. Every day we're learning more, and it will change tomorrow. If, for example, confirmation of life is announced on Mars, how would that change you? But thank you for the question. Appreciate it.
Thank you for answering.
Thank you, Dr. Ocampo. That was terrific.
Thank you.
That's good.